I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Cal Ripken and Lou Gehrig are forever linked in history as the two great Iron Men of baseball. For decades, Gehrig's record of 2,130 consecutive games played seemed an insurmountable mark until Cal Ripken met it and surpassed it by more than 500 games. By the time Ripken retired in 2001 at the age of 40, he and Gehrig were the only two of 17,000 players in the major leagues who had played more than 2,000 games in a row. The history of their amazing achievements is chronicled in a new book by John Eisenberg, who fills his account with stories not only of Ripken and Gehrig, but of the other Iron Men who endured injuries and the vagaries of managers to make their marks as tenacious everyday players. John Eisenberg on The Streak. Midday starts right after the news. Welcome, everybody. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. The Orioles will send only one player to the All-Star game in Miami tomorrow night. Second baseman Jonathan Scope is on the reserve list. Last year, Baltimore sent five players, but the O's have had a tough time of it lately. They beat the Twins last night, but they are 7.5 games out of first place as they head into the All-Star break. Injuries have plagued the team, and several stars are having truncated and or less than stellar seasons. So today, with perhaps less to smile about with the current team, we look back more than 20 years to remember the amazing achievement of one of the most beloved Orioles and beloved athletes in history, Cal Ripken Jr. In a new book about a very familiar subject, John Eisenberg puts Cal's accomplishments of playing 2,632 consecutive games in the context of baseball history, particularly as it compares to his closest rival for the record, Lou Gehrig. Gehrig and Ripken were not the only ones who achieved long consecutive games streaks. Many others aspired to play every day, and several players made it past the 1,000 game mark. But Eisenberg observes that of the 17,000 players who have played in the major leagues, Ripken and Gehrig were the only two who played in more than 2,000 games in a row. John Eisenberg gives us a detailed, assiduously reported recounting of the Gehrig and Ripken streaks, and he reminds us of those players who also tried but failed to reach the marks set by those two giants of the game. His book is called The Streak, Lou Gehrig, Cal Ripken Jr., and Baseball's Most Historic Record. John, welcome back. It's good to see you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate those kind words. Appreciate being here.
I love this book. This is a really great read, even if you're not a baseball fan. I mean, if you're just a fan of a story of, you know, incredible human endurance, because it really is, you know, there's so many players, not just Gehrig and Ripken, you know, who overcame some pretty hardy obstacles to get where they got. I want you to start with a story that actually you include at the end of the book. And this is the 1st of September 2015, when Cal Ripken is 55 years old. It's now 20 years after the streak, and he's invited to throw out the first pitch at the Orioles game that night. What happens?
Well, he's invited to throw out the first pitch that night as a commemoration, the 20th year celebration of the night that he passed Gehrig, famous iconic moment. So they're celebrating it, the 20 years, and it's this great moment, the guy that never took a day off. And so that day he's riding his bike, had a business meeting in Canton. He falls off his bike and injures himself, and it turns out that it was a serious shoulder injury. No way he could have played through it back in the day. So they didn't cancel the commemoration that night. The Orioles were playing a home game. He goes out there, and he's going to throw the first pitch. And so he's dressed, and I think I was there that night.
He's throwing it to his best friend, Brady Anderson.
He's throwing it to Brady, and he tells Brady, as they're in the tunnel getting ready to go out, he goes, "Dude, I am hurt. I am injured. I am going to go about halfway to the mound and throw you this." Because he, as it turned out, had torn his rotator cuff, a major injury that would have ended the streak. So I found that wonderfully – well, it's a story about age, isn't it? But it's also a story of you know, the things that he avoided for all those years.
Yeah, you know? And he did manage to, you know, get the ball to Brady, you know, halfway between the mound and home plate, and then he was operated on like 2 days later.
Yeah. So if you look at the video, yeah, very careful. If you look at the video from that moment, because a lot of people were chronicling that, He's just out on the grass there, and it's like, well, why is the Iron Man throwing it from like 30 feet away?
And that's pretty impressive that with a busted rotator cuff, you can even propel the ball 10 feet. I mean, that's really quite something. Well, you know, you ask the question in this book, who cares that you played consecutive games? I mean, there are other records that you talk about, you know, and Ripken himself even said, you know, I would have been happy to have had more home runs, more hits, et cetera. But do people care? I mean, obviously we here in Baltimore cared an awful lot 20 years ago, 22 years ago when this happened. But do you think the climate and the zeitgeist of Major League Baseball and Major League fans has changed dramatically? Do people care about that thing anymore?
No, they absolutely do not. It has changed. Cal's last game was in 2001. That's the retirement of the Iron Man there. Here we are, you know, not even two decades later. The longest consecutive game streak active in the major leagues now is 260 games. That's Alcides Escobar. It's a shortstop for the Kansas City Royals. And I can guarantee you one thing, it won't go on that much longer because it just doesn't happen anymore. Teams and players do not emphasize it. They want you to take a day off. There's more and more reasons for players to take a day off, which I enumerate in the book. I mean, there's, first of all, sports medicine, much more advanced than it's been in terms of the diagnostic abilities of injuries. Used to be, if you had something sore, they'd say, well, just get out there. Well, now you might have a torn hip or something, so they're much better at that. The other is big money, without a doubt. If a player making a lot of money is touch and go to play, the team is not going to risk their investment. They're going to tell him to sit. And another reason is what they call analytics, you know, which is these advanced statistics that a manager almost any night can figure out. You can bench your best player if the reserve has a better, say, average against the starting pitcher that night, left-handed in Miller Park or whatever it is. There's all these quantifications. And so
what the temperature is that night, you know. Yeah, right.
So it's really science. There's a lot more science to baseball. And so here comes this consecutive game streak. Very unscientific, I think, if you ask me. You know, it's a philosophy. So science has trumped philosophy, without a doubt, in modern baseball. And so consecutive, they're gone. I don't think Cal's record will ever be touched.
He started the streak unknowingly on the 30th of May, 1981. His first major...
82.
82? Okay, yeah. 82. That's right. And, you know... Obviously wasn't thinking about it 2,600 games later. When did it kick in that this was going to happen? When did people start thinking, including Cal himself, start thinking, okay, Gehrig's record is in sight? When did it become important?
Well, of course, he insisted and will always insist, still did all these years later, that the streak itself never became important to him, that, you know, this was his philosophy. I will admit I went into this project with a bit of skepticism about that, as I did back when I was at the Baltimore Sun writing about it. But I came out of this understanding him, if you really put it in context, it really was who Cal was. He had a consecutive game streak in the minor leagues. People don't know this, but he played in his last 258 straight minor league games. And then he played in almost 8,000 straight innings early in his career for the Orioles. So his father instilled this in him, that this is what you do, you know, and he took it and ran with it way beyond what anyone imagined. But that was his philosophy. So I think...
Yeah, and it was kind of like the fans get up every morning and they go to work.
Yes.
They do their thing. They don't take days off when they don't have a cold, you know, where they don't feel where they, you know, twisted their arm or something. Yeah. And Cal, just this sort of work ethic thing.
Yes, and so by about 89, I'd say, and that was around when he got to a thousand games. I have a scene in the book that Brady Anderson, his teammate at the time, told me that they were standing out in the outfield one day in Fenway Park, and Cal was sort of in a pensive mood. This was during batting practice, and Brady, who was younger, just said, "What's up with you?" And he says, they started talking about it. It was on Cal's mind. He says, "Do you think it's a big deal? Is this a big deal?" And Brady, who's a sharp guy, and studied some baseball history, said, "Well, yeah, I do think it's a big deal. Lou Gehrig's record is one of the most attainable, most amazing things in baseball." And then they didn't really talk about it after that. But Brady said very briefly, sort of the waters parted, and they talked about it. So that tells you that he was thinking about it. He wasn't even halfway there.
1,000-plus games away from breaking Garrett's record. He says, you quote him saying that, and I guess this was in a recent interview that you talked to him for the book, and this is not back at the time, that people think my goal in life was to build the streak, but the opposite was true. I would rather have had more hits, more home runs. The streak just happened. That just doesn't seem credible to me. I mean, does it seem credible to you?
Well, certainly in and of itself, no. I mean, it seems like at some point the streak became really important to him and he wanted to do it. But I'm here. And believe me, as I said, I came into this with quite a bit of skepticism about it. But the context that I mentioned, the fact that he always did this, he did this in the minor leagues. He did this as a young man playing in 8,000 straight innings. His father instilled this in him. And it was like, here's what you do, son, if you're going to play baseball.
Yeah.
You get up, you go to the ballpark, you take batting practice, you take infield, you get your head in the game, and if you're healthy and able, you play.
And one of the great ironies that you touch on is that in 1987, on the 14th of September, he was taken out of a game after this consecutive innings streak, 8,264 innings, and he was taken out by his dad. His dad was the manager at the time.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild.
Yeah, yeah. And
could anyone else have done it, maybe?
Yes. I think the consecutive inning streak was a different creature. It was you could make the case that was borderline insane. I mean, you know, to never take an inning off at all. Games were a different story. But he felt like Cal Sr., who, of course, passed away many years ago, but you know, he's quoted extensively about this incident, said that he felt like Cal was under, and he was still a young man, he was 27 years old at that point, was under a lot of scrutiny for doing this thing. And Cal Sr., the baseball lifer, made the decision, it's not that important. It's not that important. So he can play in the game, but that night they were behind 18-3, and yeah, they'd given up 10 home runs. They were getting crushed, and it was, if you're ever going to do it, why don't you take an inning off, son, and then we don't have to worry about this anymore.
Yeah, don't worry about it anymore. And, of course, Cal never bought the argument that you needed a day off or 2 days off to recuperate or to rest. I mean, especially when he was going through slumps. I mean, every player goes through slumps. It's just part of the thing that happens in the major leagues. And there are people who say, well, if I just take a little time, don't play for a couple days or maybe more, and then I'll come back, I'll be fresher, I can, you know, have a new lease on life. Cal never bought that.
Never bought it, and I interviewed a number of people on this subject. This is another one of the issues that comes up. Does it help? Does a day off help? Would it have mattered? Would it have helped? Brooks Robinson, you know, was a great guy to talk to on that. He's kind of laughing about it. He said, well, about half they did it to me all the time. And he said, about half the time it worked, and about half the time I did even worse when I came back. So, and Frank Robinson told me, I never believed that a day off helped, but yet a number of players do believe it. And so I would say more players believe that a day off does help you. And so that's probably where the consensus lies, but it is not unanimous by any stretch of the imagination.
And while it was going on, there were haters. I mean, there were people who thought this was a bad idea, that it was selfish, that it was, you know, Ripken was sort of self-consumed, and if he really were a team player, he would take the day off. Buster Olney used to write for The Sun, now with ESPN, and other writers really came down on him pretty hard. We got to remember that this was not universally accepted as a great idea.
No, and as I do some promotion for this book around the country doing other things, people... Here in Baltimore, we kind of know that. I mean, certainly any Oriole fan with a little bit of history behind them, that's called old. They remember that Cal was controversial at times. But elsewhere in the country, they are astounded by this. They said, what? The great Iron Man was assailed by anyone? Why would anyone ever possibly do that. But listen, I was in the Baltimore Sun in an opinion-making role, and you know, I'm not sure I was always, you know, 100%, and certainly some of my colleagues weren't. But and that's a difference. One of the differences between their streaks. Gehrig never faced that type of scrutiny. But Cal absolutely refused to let any type of scrutiny like that or criticism. I'm not saying it didn't get to him, but he didn't let it bend him over to the point where he gave in.
John Eisenberg, the new book is called The Streak: Lou Gehrig, Cal Ripken Jr., and Baseball's Most Historic Record. By the way, John will be talking about the book tonight at the Ivy Bookshop, and he will be continuing to talk about it right here on Midday when we come back from a break. Our number is 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. If you want to join us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. We take you out with a little Iron Man, Black Sabbath, from the album, the Celestial award-winning album, Paranoid, back from 1970. We will be back in 90 seconds.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
For the past 2 weeks, you've been reading about a bad brag. Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
The great Lou Gehrig, who had recently been diagnosed with ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, a fatal neurological disease that now has become known as Lou Gehrig's disease. That's him speaking at Yankee Stadium on the 4th of July, 1939, Lou Gehrig Appreciation Day. By the way, coming up tomorrow here on Midday, Professor Angela J. Davis of American University's Washington College of Law and Sherilyn Eiffel, the president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, are going to talk about a new book of essays edited by Dr. Davis called Policing the Black Man, Arrest, Prosecution, and Imprisonment. The essays are written by prominent criminal justice experts about the ways black men are targeted and convicted within our criminal justice system. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, we are spending the hour with John Eisenberg. He's a columnist for the BaltimoreRavens.com, and he was for many years a sports columnist for the Baltimore Sun. We're talking about his latest book. It's called The Streak: Lou Gehrig, Cal Ripken Jr., and Baseball's Most Historic Record. To join our conversation, we would love to have you call in or send us an email or tweet us. 410-662-8780 is the number. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So the comparisons, John, between Lou Gehrig and Cal Ripken, where do they diverge? What are different? What was different by the time Ripken started playing in the 80s when Lou Gehrig playing, you know, he retired in 1939?
Well, I think it's almost better to ask what was the same, because they're so different. Even though it's the same record, it's the same game, ostensibly the same rules with some minor tweaks, their streaks are so different because baseball had evolved. Lou Gehrig, for instance, never played one inning of night baseball. His entire streak unfolded in the heat of the day. The game started every day at 3 o'clock for years. So certainly that was easier, I think, for Lou. Cal Ripken, but Lou played every inning also on natural grass. Much better for both of those guys had bad backs, and much better than that. Cal played on that infernal, those artificial surfaces that started in the 70s.
It's like playing on cement. Yeah.
It was cement. It was a green carpet laid over cement. There's hundreds of athletes from that era. They all have replaced hips and knees, and that has a lot to do with it. Also, travel would be another one. Lou Gehrig traveled by train. But he also never played. He played in two time zones, East and Central, because there was no Major League Baseball west of St. Louis. Cal traveled by planes luxuriously. However, he played in Canada, played in domes. He played in places, much more travel. So who had it easier?
Jet lag.
Jet lag.
Dealing with that, if you're playing on the West Coast.
Yeah. It was a whole different thing entirely. And my opinion, much harder on Ripken, I think.
You note that 5 of the 15 longest streaks in baseball were in the 1950s. Is there anything particular about, so this is after Gehrig, before Ripken. Is there anything particular about that era that, you know, had so many people, you know, staying in every single game?
Well, if you go through the history, here's how I think that happened, is that, of course, Gehrig's streak became very famous. I mean, renowned. It was an amazing achievement. One of the three or four in the sports history to that point. And then we get through the war years, and I get the feeling it was a little bit more of a naive approach to it. It was like, well, this is something to aspire to. This is great, this record. There were no analytics, you know, the sports medicine, all the things I'm talking about. Later, it was a little more innocent in that respect. And so these guys, plus managers, they would just play guys all the time. So there was more of an everyday, teams had everyday lineups almost. So some streaks unfolded. And a lot of them really went through a lot of shenanigans just to keep these streaks going. It seemed to care. They seemed to care, unlike today. It really seemed to matter to them to have these long consecutive game streaks. And I guess maybe one or two of them thought, well, I'll eventually get to Gehrig. I mean, they never got close.
Yeah. John Eisenberg, the new book is called The Streak, Lou Gehrig, Cal Ripken Jr., and Baseball's Most Historic Record. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. We'd love to have you join us on Twitter as well. The handle is @MiddayTomHall. So, John, in 1973... The league sort of tried to codify a little bit what the rules were surrounding this. Because the other thing we should talk about, we talk about the consecutive innings that Ripken played. In most of the games in his streak, the 2,600-plus games, he was playing most of the game. He was playing almost all of the game most of the time. Gehrig sometimes had one game where he got up in the first inning, he batted, and then he had a pinch runner for him, so he actually never even took the field. But it counts as a game. It counts as him playing because he's in the starting lineup. How did the rules evolve, and what were they post-1973? And, of course, again, Ripken started, 8 years after that.
Well, it's very interesting that the story of the rules I found fascinating. But if you go back to the early 1900s, it was just, well, there were no rules about game appearances. If you played, you played was sort of the approach, and no one was really paying any attention to it. And so there was definitely, you could, if you wanted to keep a streak going, you could come in and face defensively, and actually this happened. Eddie Yost played for the Washington Senators in the 1950s. He had a good streak going, and he had a bad back at one point, and he would start the game on the bench, and then his manager would bring him in, and he would stand at third base for two batters, and then they'd take him out and say, well, he played. So that was it. So real shenanigans going on there. And I think that in the early 70s, I mean, no one seemed to care about this, but in the early 70s, they made an attempt. This was a period in time when the designated hitter was coming in. Okay, that's the year it did. And there was even talk with Crazy Charlie Finley of a designated runner that was going to go in. And so I think the powers that be in baseball said, we have to get serious about this. What counts as a game if you actually played? And they made the decision that a pinch running appearance did not count. If you look at the language, and the whole reason for that was because Charlie Finley was squawking about a designated runner, which never happened. But at DH, they decided, yeah, you did. So they made it official, either a half inning of defense or one at bat. You had to do, you couldn't stand there for, four pitches and come out. So they codified it, as you said. And I think that was for the better.
There are so many times in Cal Ripken's, peregrination towards the streak that it almost ended. There was a time in Gehrig's, during Gehrig's streak, and you mentioned that the Yankees actually, talking about shenanigans, they kind of moved the time of a game. I mean, they changed when it was going to come because there was some concern that Mr. Gehrig wasn't going to make it to the ballpark on time. Tell us that story, and then did the Orioles or any other team in Major League Baseball have to do any of those kinds of shenanigans to make sure that Ripken's streak stayed intact?
Well, the of course, the one with Gehrig, Garrick's history was pretty funny because he was pretty far along, just short of the record. And he was a mama's boy. I think that's safe to say about Lou Gehrig, if you know that. He was the opposite of Babe Ruth in many respects. And so his mother had a court date one day, and she'd been in an auto accident and was being sued. And so she was going to court. So he was not going to let his mother go to court without he was going to accompany her. Well, the Yankees had a game that day, 3 o'clock, as always. And I think it was cloudy in New York that morning. And the Yankees canceled the game and by noon. And it never rained. And there's been great, great speculation that they felt like, well, Lou might be he's going to be testifying. He can't play first base, and we don't want a streak to end that way. So if you really investigate that, though, I debunked this a little bit in the book. It's a great conspiracy theory, and I love them as much as everybody else. But they did that like 6 or 7 times. They did it all the time. They were going to play the St. Louis Browns that day, the worst team in baseball. There were going to be maybe 100 people at the ballpark. And routinely in the early 30s, the Yankees would cancel a game early in the season, replay it or reschedule it for July as part of a doubleheader when they would have 40 or 50,000 people there. Gate attendance was their main source of revenue. This is before TV or radio or TV, primarily TV money. So they did that all the time. And I don't know. I mean, no one's around to defend themselves. But if you ask me, it was more that than anything else. As a matter of fact, he never did get called to testify, and he probably could have made the game.
Cal Ripken, for a while, as the streak continued, people started thinking about it. People started asking him about it all the time. People were literally bothering him about it. He has these, as you say, you know, this incredible work ethic. He had his routine that he did every day before the games. And then after the games, he was sometimes kept for hours and hours and hours. Reporters asking him stuff, fans asking him stuff. At one point, he asked the team if it would be okay for him to stay in a different hotel than the rest of the team and even travel on a fake name, I guess, an assumed name, differently than the rest of the team. And I remember when I first read about this, it was couched in terms of Cal was this arrogant guy who was above the rest of the team. He wasn't a team player. He was anything but. He was, you know, certainly the best player or one of the best players on the team. And that this notion that he had to stay in a different place and even fly on a different plane was an indication of his selfishness. That's how it was often reported at the time. What's your take on that? You have a different take, I think, in the book.
Well, yeah. I mean, I certainly was right in the mix of things when that was happening. And that is, you're correct. I mean, there was a lot of thought that Cal thinks he's a bigger man than the streak, and that's far more important. And this is exhibit A of the fact that he doesn't, you know, he puts his own record ahead of the team. But really, if you do examine it, you know, and this is his telling of the story. That's really all I have to go by, and some other people, was that he was being besieged. I mean, he couldn't even go down the hall for ice. I mean, there were autograph seekers all over the place. That is for sure. And he tells these stories. Sports Illustrated put him on the cover with this stuff, talking about how, you know, I to and from the ballpark, his cabs were being chased by autograph hunters and things like this. It was getting to be a huge deal, and it bugged him. It definitely bugged him. He felt like, I can't prepare as well as I want to. Now, you know what? If people are free to believe that he thought that was you know, it was some act of selfishness. I do think that, you know, he was a child of routine, and his routine was being disrupted. And you know, maybe it's not great for team chemistry, but in the end, I don't know that it's really that big of a deal.
Bob in Perry Hall wonders who played the most total games ever. You talk about this in the book. So not consecutive games, but just the total number of games. And it's actually a guy who's not in the Hall of Fame.
That's right. He's not in the Hall of Fame. It's Pete Rose. Pete Rose is an Iron Man in his own right, just by not how we quantify an Iron Man. We, at some point, an Iron Man became known as a consecutive games streak. Pete Rose is the equal of Gehrig and Ripken in many respects. Full games, full seasons of games.
Charlie Hustle,
a full season of games, say 162 games. He had almost as many as Gehrig. He played, and he, of course, he played for 25 years. So he had, I think, 10 seasons of full without missing a game. So, but it just so happened that his injuries or illnesses came along. He has two of the 15 longest streaks in history, but neither was longer than 800 games. And that's just because he would get hurt and he'd ram into somebody and, you know, he'd be out. But in many respects, Pete Rose is right there with these guys, but he, just because of how we determine or define an Ironman as, he is not considered that at all.
But the person who does hold the record for the most full seasons of games is actually Cal Ripken.
That's correct.
Right. Yeah. Although, yes. And Rose certainly had. You also mentioned a metric of the best decade, so yeah. a ten year period, and again, it's not Cal, is it?
The best decade? Cal did have a decade. I mean, he didn't.
But just in terms of the overall best decade, you say that it's, again, Pete Rose had actually the best, you know, if you take a 10-year chunk.
Well, he missed four games.
Yeah.
He missed four games in a 10-year period. So I'm talking about other than Ripken and Gehrig. They were perfect.
Yeah.
They didn't miss a game. Cal was 15 years. Gehrig was 13, I believe that's what that was.
Yeah.
But Pete Rose was four games over. That's the closest to them. That's pretty good.
We have a number of people asking about a conspiracy theory that there was a lighting malfunction that the Orioles invented in 1997 against the Mariners so that Cal Ripken could get to the game on time and keep his streak. I actually don't remember reading about this in the book. Maybe I've just forgotten, but there were people, I remember people talking about this, that, you know, this is one of those times where they fudged a little bit and they came up with an excuse for starting the game later.
Yes, this is one of the great internet rumors. And so, when I took this subject on, I investigated this at length to determine whether or not this should be included in the book. And the story was they were playing the Seattle Mariners, and the Bank of Lights went out, 6 o'clock or something like that, and the lights went dark, and they couldn't play. And the reason, the conspiracy theory, is that Cal had gotten into some sort of legal trouble and was unable to make the game and couldn't get there in time. Well, if you investigate this, there's footage. The lights eventually, I mean, there was a period of time when the lights did come back on and the players are warming up and throwing. Well, if you look at the video footage from that period, of course, there's video of everything. Yeah. He's on the field. Plus, there was also behind-the-scenes negotiations. Once the lights went out, this always happens in baseball, the union reps from each side will get together and say, well, if we have to reschedule this game, how can we do it? Here are our days off. We do this. The union is involved in this. It's a union issue. And the Seattle guy gave an interview a number of years later because he kept hearing about this thing. And he said, we were talking to Cal. You know, Cal was in there. So I made the judgment that I didn't think that necessarily. I know it's a shock, but there's like a lot of internet rumors. You know, maybe this one did not need to be included in the book.
That's right. Almost everything we hear on the internet is true, obviously.
Right.
But maybe not this in this one little instance. Yeah.
Right. Right.
John Eisenberg, the book is called "The Streak: Lou Gehrig, Cal Ripken Jr., and Baseball's Most Historic Record." We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll talk more about Gehrig, Ripken, and some other names that you may not be familiar with, some other guys who had some pretty long streaks themselves. 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org. If you want to join us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. I'm glad you're with us. Stick around.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday on Mondays here on our program. It is our practice to read the names of the people who lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 183 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Last week, 11 people were the victims of homicide in our city. They are Louis C. Young, age 22, Dion M. Solomon, age 29, Malcolm Parker, age 47, Charlie Stevenson, age 54, Ronnie Banks, age 56, Elijah Stratton, age 32, Einming Huang, age 63, George Thompson, age 43, Daryl Owens, age 23, and Alves Stevens, age 50. In addition, last week the medical examiner ruled that the death of David Miles was a homicide. Mr. Miles died last February from injuries he sustained in an assault in October of 2003. He was 36 years old. Also, Deanne Smith, 24 years old, was killed last week. He is the brother of Baltimore City Police Department spokesman T.J. Smith. We work with T.J. regularly here at Midday, and we extend our condolences to T.J. and to the families of all of the victims who lost their lives to violence last week. If you've just joined us, it's Midday. I'm Tom Hall, and we are talking about a considerably cheerier subject than homicides in the city of Baltimore. We're talking about The Streak, a new book by John Eisenberg, former sports columnist for the Baltimore Sun, currently writes for BaltimoreRavens.com. The book is called The Streak, Lou Gehrig, Cal Ripken Jr., and Baseball's Most Historic Record. Here's Cal Ripken speaking on the night that he broke Lou Gehrig's record in Camden Yards back in 1995.
For all of your support over the years, I want to thank you, the fans of Baltimore, from the bottom of my heart. This is the greatest place to play.
That was quite a night. You begin the book talking about that evening. Tell us about the background to Cal running around the stadium. That took a while to get underway. All of us, I think, or many of us remember the video of Rafael Palmeiro sort of pushing him out of the dugout. But that wasn't something that he had planned, certainly. I mean, what's the background? You were in the ballpark that night. I was watching it on TV. What happened?
Well, it was entirely organic, that moment, which was what made it so great. The Orioles and Ripken had gone to great lengths to sort of stage what was going to happen on the night he tied the record and then the night he passed Gehrig. And they went through these lovely ceremonies before, during, and after the game. But when he did break the record, of course, the fans were just cheering so loudly and so long that they just wouldn't stop. And he went through.
We should remind folks that this is the middle of the game. I mean, he breaks the record in the middle of the fifth inning when it's considered a complete game. So
yeah.
The umpires and the other team, everybody had they had four more innings to play.
Four more innings to play, and the umpire. I interviewed the umpires. I mean, I recreate that scene, start the book with it, and I was determined to get fresh voices because I interviewed a fan, I interviewed one of the policemen on the field, I interviewed an umpire who was great, and some of the California Angels who were there, just new voices that I hadn't heard because I felt like I'd heard a lot of it. I wanted to create a fresh perspective, but and some of the people in the Oriole dugout, and that was Cal was sitting there, and they wouldn't stop, and he was We have to play this game. After a while, it's not going to end. And so, actually, it was Palmeiro and Bobby Bonilla, who was on the team at the time. They said, "Why don't you go out there and shake their hands?" And he's like, "What?" And he said, "Just go shake a hand or something. Maybe they'll stop." Having no idea that he would do that. He had no idea. When they pushed him down out onto the field, he was just to acknowledge the crowd. he sort of wandered down to the railing, shook a few hands, and of course the place just went crazy, and he's just started going. He started going, and it just evolved from there, entirely impromptu and organic, and I think that's what made it so great.
Let's go to the phones. David in Towson, welcome to Midday with John Eisenberg.
Yeah, I just want to say I'm going to have to read your book, John, but Cal's streak will probably never be broken. But if you want to do another book on a streak that cannot be broken, well, I'll talk about Tippi Martinez. Of course, it'll be a short book.
One inning.
Yeah.
the callers were referring to a reliever for the Orioles, Tippi Martinez, who picked off all three. It was a year, I think they won the World Series, the Orioles, or it was in the early 80s. They're playing Milwaukee Brewers at Memorial Stadium, and all three Brewer batters got on, and he picked all three of them off first base.
Yeah, three pickoffs in one inning.
You can't top it. That's one you can't break.
Yeah, you can't break. They don't have four outs in an inning.
No.
Charlie Finley notwithstanding, that's a rule that ain't going to change.
Right.
You do talk about other Ironmen. Of course, Ripken, everybody who was around at the time remembers the unfurling the cloth numbers 2131 on that day, September 5th, 1995. But the world record holder for consecutive games wasn't in the major leagues. Tell us about Sachio Kinugasa.
Sachio Kinugasa was the Japanese. He was the Japanese Iron Man. And actually, Japanese baseball, I actually knew this. It's much more of you do whatever the manager says, and there's a lot more emphasis given on the team. You know, if you're going to play every day, Ripken almost had more of his approach was much more, would have been more at home in Japanese baseball. So the Sachio Kinugasa played in 2,215 games, I think. And so I don't have the number right in front of me.
2,215.
And so the next year, Cal's getting ready to pass him, so they flew him in. And this was the world record. Kinugasa came in. He was retired. He's just a little bald guy. And he had played third base. And they brought him in. And actually, I was there for that. I covered that. I was still the Baltimore Sun. And those two guys got along great. It was just amazing. I mean, they brought him in, and they had needed translators. But, you know, I think they spent maybe an evening at the hotel bar and a few other things. And they hit it off and have become friends. Kinugasa comes in for some of the Ripken Foundation stuff that they've done. They've become very, very good friends. And I thought when I interviewed Cal for the book 20 years later, he says, you know, talking to him made it, that was the closest I was going to get to talking to Lou Gehrig, he felt like, because he was an older man and he had done this, and it's a very select club. And, you know, I personally thought that was pretty cool that, number one, you know, that they got along so well.
Yeah, that's
great. They hit it off.
That's terrific. Phil in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with John Eisenberg.
Oh, good afternoon, gentlemen. I've been a baseball fan since 1964. I think Lou Gehrig was a much better hitter. He had a .340 lifetime batting average, one of the highest in baseball history. Cal Ripken, .276. Gehrig had 493 home runs. Ripken, 431. So it's a great achievement for both men to streak. But I really think Gehrig, honestly, was a better overall player. And also, Cal Ripken has one dubious record. He is hit into more double plays than anyone in baseball history. Although Albert Pujols may break that soon, hopefully, and then Ripken's only number two in that category. But I've enjoyed this program very much, and thank you.
Well, thanks for your call, Phil. I mean, in terms of overall, you know, production, overall stats and stuff, Gehrig over Ripken?
Oh, no argument about it, and Cal would lead that argument. I mean, he made the comment to me when I interviewed him for this. He said he's almost embarrassed by the comparison to Lou Gehrig. Lou was like Babe Ruth. I mean, his numbers are he's one of the greatest offensive players in history of baseball. And if he were playing today, he would be making unbelievable. There were years when he had 175 RBIs, which is a crazy number, and he's batting behind Babe Ruth, who cleared the bases a lot. So Lou Gehrig, an awesome offensive player, one of the best ever, and very few people in history, very few Hall of Famers compare to Lou Gehrig.
Frank Robinson, Johnny Oates, some of the managers that managed Cal after his father was sort of inauspiciously fired by the organization, which actually gave Cal, led to Cal thinking, well, maybe I'll leave Baltimore too. I mean, yep. He entertained some ideas about that, of course, never did. They talked about, some of these other managers talked about Ripken's value to the team that sort of transcended what he was hitting or how he was fielding. I mean, there were times when there were young pitchers, young catchers in for the Orioles, Ripken was calling the pitches from shortstop.
Yes, Ben McDonald told me that story. Of course, a former first-round pick. He's now on TV a lot. Was a real good young pitcher. Got hurt. But he told a story that he's out there. He's a young pitcher. Chris Hoyles was the catcher, a young catcher. As Ben told it, we didn't know what we were doing, and we needed help. And so Cal started sitting in on the pitchers' meetings and then started calling some of the pitches. Now, the manager, Phil Regan, this is the year 95 that he broke the record. The manager did not know this was happening and called him in and said, I heard you're calling the pitches or what's going on here. And Cal said, I'm sorry, but yeah, it's right. And he said, no, it's all right. Go ahead. But yes, you really get to an important part of his his defense of why this was a worthwhile thing was that, yeah, he quarterbacked the infield for all those years. Certainly early in his career, an awesome offensive player, sort of leveled out as a steady producer for the most part. So, and there were times when he slumped. But Frank Robinson, Johnny Oates, Regan that year said, I had no problem putting him out there every day because our defense would have fallen apart without him. And he was just a stabilizing factor, and they wanted him out there for that and other reasons.
And when Ripken was drafted by the Orioles, when he was 20 years old, I guess, 21, something like that, he was drafted as a pitcher.
Yeah, drafted, I think, out of high school at 18.
Yeah.
So, yes, he was a pitcher. He was a high school pitcher. And the team
asked. And that's kind of normal, isn't it? The kids in high school, the best player on the team, you put him in as pitcher. He could also very well be the best hitter on the team.
Right.
Unlike
right.
the major leagues where the pitchers are not generally known for their hitting prowess.
They asked him, too. He was 17. Was it 17 years old? I think he was 17. They asked him, you know, what do you want to do? Do you want to pitch? Do you want to play every day? He was a good pitcher. There are people in your listening audience that, you know, there's a lot of people out there that played high school ball against Cal Ripken when he was the pitcher and a real good one. But he said, you know, I think I want to play every day. I don't want to sit 4 out of 5 days. I want to play. It's as simple as that. He was a kid making that judgment, and it was a key one, I would say.
And who decided he should play shortstop as opposed to, you know, left field or someplace?
Well, this was a major organizational question. They saw him as a third baseman because he's big. He's a big guy, and the prototypical shortstop for many years was a slender little rabbit, defensive guy.
Louis Aparicio, those kind of guys.
Yeah, a little ballerina or whatever. And so they saw him as a third baseman. He started as a third baseman. He was played shortstop and third throughout his minor league career. They brought him up as a third baseman, and they were playing him at third base. And then Earl Weaver made the decision, you're going to be a shortstop. And he wound up starting 2,215 straight games at shortstop until he moved back to third near the end of his career, where Pat Gillick was the general manager. He made that decision, and he said, I always thought he profiled better as a third baseman. But he had a very distinguished career as shortstop.
And, of course, when he started in the minor leagues, he had a very inauspicious beginning. I mean, he made 33 errors in 62 games, and then a year later, he was the rookie MVP, or the rookie of the year, and the year after that, the MVP of the league. So it's amazing how sort of quickly he turned things around from a rather inauspicious beginning in his career.
Yeah, as a minor leaguer straight out of high school, he struggled. And then in single-A baseball in 1979 in Miami, he continued to struggle. And the people that he played with and he played with said, you know, he was evolving physically and that the light bulb just suddenly came on. By 1980, he was an all-star at double-A, and then he was a prospect and on his
way. And as we say, the rest is history.
Right.
All right. Well, John, this is a terrific read. I appreciate your coming by and talking about it. Thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
John Eisenberg, the new book's called The Streak, Lou Gehrig, Cal Ripken Jr., and Baseball's Most Historic Record. You can meet John tonight at the Ivy Bookshop in North Baltimore. He's going to be talking about the book there at 7 o'clock. Our website, wipr.org/midday, has a link to details. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday, a conversation about race and justice in America with Sherrilyn Ifill, the president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and Angela Davis of the Washington College of Law at American University. Just last month, a police officer who killed a motorist, Philando Castile, during a traffic stop in Minnesota, joined the ranks of many officers who have been involved in fatal incidents involving people of color who have either not been indicted or not been convicted. So why is it so difficult to successfully prosecute law enforcement officials? We'll talk about that kind of stuff and a new book of essays that explores this and many aspects of the justice system. If you can join us for that tomorrow on Midday. We want to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today. They're located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.